Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Chad Radler. I'm a judge on the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. More importantly, for today's purposes, I'm a past president of the Columbus Lawyers Chapter of the Federal Society. So I admire Robert, who had to introduce six judges today. Happily, I only have one to introduce, but this is quite a judge, let me tell you. William Pryor is the chief judge of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit. He resides in Birmingham, Alabama. Judge Pryor was appointed to the bench in 2004 by President Bush, and ever since, he's been considered a top contender for a seat on the Supreme Court. Judge Pryor was born in Mobile. He graduated at the top of his class from law school and went on to clerk on the Fifth Circuit for Judge John Minor Wisdom. Now, in addition to his judicial service, his public service includes time on the U.S. Sentencing Commission and also as the Attorney General of Alabama from 1997 to 2004. Now, immediately before he became Attorney General, he was Deputy Attorney General, and he worked under then-Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who I also had the pleasure of working with more recently. If you spend more than, or even just 5 minutes with Judge Pryor, there will be two things that will become evident very quickly. One is that he has a masterful command of constitutional law and methods of constitutional and statutory interpretation. And as you'll hear, as you'll hear later, he's not shy about sharing those views. Two, he is a rabid Alabama football fan. I didn't expect that to be an applause line. Before I sit down, I want to give one anecdote about Judge Pryor. To be honest, it's actually a story about me. This is a veiled way to talk about myself. 22 years ago, I was an associate at Jones Day Columbus working with our chief judge, Jeff Sutton. And now Judge Sutton had a case in the Supreme Court, Alabama versus Garrett, about the ADA and whether state immunity could be abrogated by Congress. The client in that case was Attorney General Pryor, representing the state of Alabama. And on the day of the argument in Washington, even though I was the junior member of the team, I was assigned the most important responsibility of the day. I wasn't arguing the case, that was Judge Sutton. I actually wasn't even sitting at counsel table, that was then General Pryor. My job was to walk to the Jones Day office in Washington, meet General Pryor, and walk him to the Supreme Court. I'm quite certain he could have found the court on his own, but nonetheless, I took great pride in the opportunity to meet the then Attorney General. And I'll say for the young lawyers in the audience, it's quite hard for me now to believe 22 years later that I'm a colleague on the court and had the chance to introduce to you Chief Judge William Pryor.
Thank you, Chad. Thanks for the memory, the trip down memory lane. Thanks for the warm introduction. It's nice to be back in Columbus. The last time I was here to speak to the Columbus chapter and to be the guest of my longtime friend, now Chief Judge Jeff Sutton. He took me to the SHU, where we watched a truly marvelous football game, one of the best football games I think I've ever seen. In 2017, Ohio State, I think, was ranked third. Penn State was ranked third. Ohio State was ranked sixth. Saquon Barkley returned the opening kickoff 97 yards for a touchdown. And at the end of the game, Ohio State came back and won the game by 1 point. The crowd rushed the field. By the way, in Tuscaloosa, we have never rushed the field. We always expect to win. I had the privilege of welcoming Judge Sutton, my friend, back to Alabama the next year for the Alabama-Texas A&M game. We won. But the bond that we've had from both the law and college football has been a special one, and I hope we get another home-and-home series very soon. Today, I want to discuss a new version of an old debate. In 1985, then Attorney General Ed Meese delivered a famous address to the American Bar Association in which he advocated a jurisprudence of original intention. Meese argued that in contrast with many modern decisions by the Supreme Court, the founders expected that the text of the document and the original intention of those who framed it would be the judicial standard in giving effect to the Constitution. He explained that judges should not depart from the literal import of the words in the Constitution, and argued, as Justice Story had two centuries earlier, that where the words admit of two senses, that sense is to be adopted, which best harmonizes with the nature and objects, the scope and design of the instrument. The backlash against Meese's speech was swift and fierce. At a law school symposium a few months later, Justice William Brennan lambasted originalism as little more than arrogance cloaked as humility. Justice Brennan instead promoted an approach whose results aligned with his personal moral vision. He argued that what mattered was what the words of the text mean in our time. And he maintained that the Constitution required judges to strive toward the goal of human dignity. Of course, it was not the founders' conception of human dignity that Justice Brennan sought to advance. Justice Brennan made it clear that it was a particular vision of human dignity that the Constitution should guarantee. For example, he argued that capital punishment was a violation of human dignity, and so unconstitutional, even though he acknowledged that most of his colleagues and most Americans disagreed. I will let you decide, as between Justice Brennan's methodology and the methodology he condemned, which of the two is better described as arrogance cloaked as humility. After the debate between Attorney General Meese and Justice Brennan, the proponents of originalism multiplied in politics, the bar, the academy, and the bench, thanks in no small part to the Federalist Society. Justice Antonin Scalia became the leading evangelist for originalism, and Justice Clarence Thomas became its leading practitioner. Four decades later, originalism has been restored as the primary interpretive philosophy of the judiciary. Today, most of the justices of the Supreme Court are originalists. They maintain that the text of the Constitution has a fixed meaning, that the Constitution means now what it originally meant, and that the original meaning is binding on them as judges. And as the justices have become less inclined toward living constitutionalism, so too has the court's jurisprudence. Consider the recent decision in Buckley versus Preciado, in which the court stated that the Constitution allows capital punishment because of its original meaning. As the court explained, that fact, quote, means that the judiciary bears no license to end a debate reserved for the people and their representatives. And contrary to Justice Brennan's view, this court acknowledges that a judge is powerless under our Constitution to abolish capital punishment, even if he or she sincerely believes that capital punishment is against human dignity, the natural law, or the common good. Tellingly, the Buckley Court ignored the formulation of the Warren Court that the Eighth Amendment must draw its meaning from the evolving standards of decency that mark the progress of a maturing society. Despite that achievement, a few individuals on the right side of the political spectrum have recently condemned the current practice of originalism. Some advocate for a new kind of originalism, so-called common good originalism, that they say is rooted in the teleology and ratio legis of the Constitution and that would allegedly secure conservative ends. Last year, in the Joseph Story Lecture at the Heritage Foundation, I explained the problems with this view, and I will not rehearse them again here. I want instead to address a kind of results-oriented jurisprudence that is indistinguishable in everything but name from Justice Brennan's living constitutionalism. Harvard Law professor Adrian Vermeule's so-called common good constitutionalism, a variant of what I call living common goodism. Vermeule's approach, in his words, takes as its starting point substantive moral principles that conduce to the common good, principles that judges should read into the majestic generalities and ambiguities of the written Constitution. End quote. Replace common good with human dignity, and Vermeule's living common goodism sounds a lot like Brennan's living constitutionalism. Indeed, the difference between Brennan's living constitutionalism and Vermeule's living common goodism consists mainly in their differing substantive moral beliefs. In practice, the methodologies are the same. Although I disagree with Vermeule's view, it would be a mistake to dismiss it out of hand. To be sure, there is little evidence that many judges or lawyers have been persuaded by Vermeule, but his view is being taken seriously by at least some law students. And because the history of the Federalist Society proves that minority views can become prevailing ones, we should take seriously even mistaken views like living common goodism. So I want to explain why Vermeule's view is mistaken. The Constitution does not give judges the power to read into the text of the Constitution substantive moral principles that conduce to the common good, and fashioning that kind of jurisprudence would conflict with natural law. As Professor Robert George has explained, when courts exceed their jurisdiction and usurp legislative authority, whether for good or bad causes, they violate the rule of law by seizing power authoritatively allocated by the framers and ratifiers of the Constitution to other branches of government. Within the bounds of the constraints it imposes, the natural law is neutral about the kind of constitution that a people can establish to promote the common good. Like the ancient moral philosophers, the founders understood that power corrupts. They gave the judiciary and other branches limited powers within separate domains for protecting the common good. They recognized, as Professor George put it, that natural law itself does not settle the question whether it falls ultimately to the legislature or the judiciary in any particular polity to ensure that the positive law conforms to natural law and respects natural rights. And as Professor Vermeule acknowledges, the common good does not by itself entail any particular scheme of judicial review of constitutional questions or even any such scheme at all. The only question for judges is the scope of their power under our Constitution. As Professor Joel Alicea recently explained in his excellent article refuting living common goodism, an enacted text is morally binding according to the natural law tradition only insofar as it is both substantively consistent with the natural law and promulgated by a legitimate authority. Judges committed to that tradition have already determined for themselves that the Constitution accords with natural law and has been promulgated by a legitimate authority, or else we would not have taken an oath to support it. As far as I can tell, Vermeule is not advocating for a revolution of our constitutional order, so we must ask whether our Constitution gives judges the power to ensure that the positive law conforms to the natural law by departing from the original meaning. If it does not, then a judge who purports to exercise that power has transgressed the natural law by going beyond the power committed to him. The nature of our written constitution conflicts with living common goodism because, as Professor Chris Green points out, our constitution refers to itself as a written text situated at a fixed time in history. Consider just a few examples. The preamble identifies our constitution with the text. The people, quote, ordained and established this constitution for the United States of America. Article 2 declares that no person except a natural born citizen or a citizen of the United States at the time of the adoption of this constitution shall be eligible to the office of president. Article 3 extends the judicial power to all cases in law and equity arising under this constitution, as distinguished from those arising under distinct bodies of law, federal statutory law, and treaties. Article 6 likewise distinguishes this constitution from the rest of the law that composes the supreme law of the land. And it requires that judicial officers be bound by oath to support this constitution. So unlike Britain's unwritten constitution, our constitution is a written text that expressed its meaning at the time of its adoption. Vermeule's failure to appreciate the nature of our constitution causes him to misunderstand what originalism claims about it. Originalism does not, as Vermeule asserts, simply equate law with positive enacted text. After all, the Constitution itself refers both to the law of nations and to the common law. Originalism instead acknowledges that our particular Constitution, novel when it was adopted, is the text with which it identifies itself. So Vermeule's view that departing from the text is not the same as departing from the law may be true of other constitutions, but it is untrue of our constitution, from which judges have no legal authority to depart. The judicial oath obliges judges as a moral duty to support the written text that is our constitution. To be sure, an oath could be immoral. Professor Alessia imagines a hypothetical constitution that in express terms mandated genocide. It would be wrong to support that constitution, even if one were wrongly to take an oath to support it. But as I have explained, judges have already determined for themselves that our constitution, as amended, is morally legitimate. If we are right, then our oath morally binds us. The oath bridges the gap between the descriptive facts about the meaning of the text that is our Constitution and the normative fact that judges are obliged to faithfully interpret what the text means. So the oath squarely presents the question whether originalists have the correct account of interpretation. If so, judges are morally bound to original meaning. On the mistaken living common goodist account, legal texts must always be read in the light of natural law, or more accurately, what a judge believes is the natural law. That is, judges may read into the text the moral principles that they believe conduce to the common good. But the problem with that account is that there is no necessary connection between the meaning of a text and any particular conception of the common good. One must know a text's meaning before one can know whether faithful application of its meaning would conduce to the common good. That fact is why we can know that a legal text serves an immoral end. For example, if we were to discover an ancient Roman edict, we would have to understand what the edict originally meant before we could form a belief about whether enforcing it instead of something distinct to which we have super added our own moral principles, would have been consistent with the natural law. So whether the text bears a particular meaning is an independent antecedent question for judges to answer, and going beyond that meaning would be going beyond the power committed to them. A major theme of Vermeule's recent popular level polemic defending living common goodism is that it supposedly prevailed at the founding. He contends that living common goodism is the original understanding of the Constitution. In his revisionist historical account, the classical legal tradition structured and suffused our law right from the beginning, long before the Constitution of 1789. And living common goodism has since been displaced by originalism, which he labels as a creature of the late 20th century. Rubbish. To begin with, it is odd that Vermeule places so much emphasis on the alleged historical basis for his view. He emphatically states that he, quote, does not advocate a revival of the classical law because it is the original understanding, but then spends many pages attempting to convince readers of the historical pedigree of his view. Vermeule does not make clear what role, if any, he believes his historical account plays in his overall argument, but surely it must play a key role. In the so-called classical tradition, law is an ordinance of reason for the common good, promulgated by a legitimate public authority. If living common goodism were not the prevailing view of the legitimate public authority at the founding, then it would be implausible to suppose that its ordinance of reason for the common good, that is, our Constitution, empowered judges to do what Vermeule would now have them do. So Vermeule's account of the founding turns out to be critical to his case. Vermeule's argument for that historical revisionism does not withstand scrutiny. He argues that three opinions, the first, Justice Harlan's dissent in Lochner versus New York, the decision of the Supreme Court in United States versus Curtis Wright, and the decision of a New York court in Riggs versus Palmer, illustrate how deeply the classical legal tradition has always infused our law. Setting aside whether these decisions support Vermeule's methodology, it strains credulity to suppose that a dissenting opinion from 1905, a Supreme Court decision from 1936, and a state court decision from 1889 could establish that living common goodism is deeply rooted in the American tradition, that it structured and suffused our law right from the beginning, long before the Constitution of 1789 was written. Vermeule's argument is about as persuasive as using Roe versus Wade as evidence that living constitutionalism is deeply rooted in our legal tradition. But even if we ignore the recency of the opinions he chose, Vermeule's argument still fails. Consider first Riggs versus Palmer, an 1889 decision of the Court of Appeals of New York. In that case, a grandson murdered his grandfather to inherit under the grandfather's will. The grandson claimed the property, and the sole question for the court's determination was whether he could have it. The relevant statute stated that no will in writing, nor any part thereof, shall be revoked or altered otherwise, except in circumstances not at issue in Riggs. The Riggs court read into the governing statute an exception for murderous heirs and held that the grandson could not inherit. The Riggs court started with what Vermeule asserts is a crucial proposition of living common goodism. A thing which is within the intention of the makers of a statute is as much within the statute as if it were within the letter, and a thing which is within the letter of the statute and is not within the statute unless it be within the intention of the makers. The Riggs court appealed to Aristotle's authority to reason that equitable constructions can restrain the letter of the statute. You can see why Vermeule likes this decision. And the court determined that it was not much troubled by the general language contained in the laws because it was inconceivable that the legislative intention was to allow the property to pass to the grandson. So I agree, Riggs is an example of living common goodism. The problem for Vermeule's argument is that most American courts of that era rejected Riggs in favor of the textualist approach he says was invented after the Second World War. For example, in Wall versus Fanschmidt, the Supreme Court of Illinois in 1914 rejected the living common goodism of Riggs. It quoted Chief Justice Marshall's 1820 opinion in United States versus Wiltberger, where there is no ambiguity in the words of a statute, there is no room for construction. And it explained that under the rules for the interpretation of statutes, the courts cannot read into a statute exceptions or limitations which depart from its plain meaning. In 1892, the Supreme Court of this great state, Ohio, affirmed a decision that expressly rejected Riggs's approach as, quote, legislation in disguise. In that case, Deem versus Milliken, the court endorsed textualism. Quote, when the legislature speaks in clear language upon a question of policy, it becomes the judicial tribunals to remain silent. And it derided the decision in Riggs as, quote, the manifest assertion of a wisdom believed to be superior to that of the legislature upon a question of policy. The dominant textualist approach that rejected Riggs was nothing new. After all, Chief Justice Marshall had in 1819 endorsed a strong textualism with a narrow absurdity canon. If in any case the plain meaning of a provision is to be disregarded because we believe the framers of that instrument could not intend what they say, it must be one in which the absurdity and injustice of applying the provision to the case would be so monstrous that all mankind would, without hesitation, unite in rejecting the application. In Reading Law, Justice Scalia and Brian Garner explained that all states now have statutes that explicitly deal with the problem of murderous errors because most American courts rejected Riggs and applied even unwise laws as written, the kind of textualism that prevails today. Consider next Justice Harlan's dissent in Lochner. Although the outlier decision in Riggs was consistent with living common goodism, Harlan's dissent in Lochner was not. The Lochner court held that a state law prohibiting bakers from working more than 60 hours in 1 week violated the supposed liberty of contract protected by the 14th Amendment. Both the majority and Harlan agreed that the 14th Amendment protects a right of contract subject to such regulations as the state may reasonably prescribe for the common good and the well-being of society. But they disagreed about whether the maximum hours law for bakers was a reasonable exercise of the state's police power. Harlan argued that the state law, quote, cannot be held to be in conflict with the 14th Amendment without enlarging the scope of the amendment far beyond its original purpose, end quote. And other famous Harlan dissents confirmed he was an originalist. In the civil rights cases, he explained that courts must follow, quote, the familiar rule requiring in the interpretation of constitutional provisions that full effect be given to the intent with which they were adopted, end quote. In Hurtado versus California, Harlan argued that the meaning of the words due process of law in the 5th and 14th Amendments, quote, must receive the same interpretation they had at the common law from which they were derived. And in Plessy versus Ferguson, of course, he argued that the 13th and 14th Amendments should be, quote, enforced according to their true intent and meaning. Finally, consider Curtis Wright. Contrary to Vermeule's account, Curtis Wright does not illustrate how deeply the classical legal tradition has always infused our law. In that decision, the Supreme Court held that a joint resolution of Congress permitting the president to prohibit the sale of arms in a foreign conflict was not an unconstitutional delegation of the lawmaking power. The court reasoned that the Union existed before the Constitution, which according to the constitutional text itself was ordained and established to form a more perfect union. The court explained that because sovereignty immediately passed to the Union from Britain, the federal government possessed powers of external sovereignty, such as the power to declare war, to conclude peace, and to make treaties that did not depend upon the affirmative grants of the Constitution. And the court acknowledged that those powers remained in the Union without change, save insofar as the Constitution, in express terms, qualified their exercise. Now, Vermeule asserts that Curtis Wright stands as a direct and flagrant affront to originalism and to the positivism of which the currently reigning version of originalism is a species, because it endorsed the shockingly anti-originalist idea that the Union existed before the Constitution. But Vermeule again attacks a straw man. Originalism does not assert that the Constitution created the Union, or that there is no law outside the written text. Originalism asserts that our Constitution is a written text that was adopted as the supreme law at a fixed point in time. And the court in Curtis Wright agreed. The court described the establishment of the written Constitution by the Union as an event in time, and it declared that the federal government retained the powers of sovereignty that preexisted that event only insofar as the Constitution in express terms did not qualify their exercise. The court explained that presidential power, like every other governmental power, must be exercised in subordination to the applicable provisions of the Constitution. Because the Constitution is supreme, the court considered whether the resolution was consistent with the Constitution. It based its ruling on, quote, the unbroken legislative practice which has prevailed almost from the inception of the national government by examining acts of Congress from as early as 1794. And it engaged in originalist reasoning by giving unusual weight to the impressive array of legislation enacted by nearly every Congress from the beginning of our national existence. Curtis Wright is not an example of living common goodism. A major theme of Vermeule's revisionism is that originalism was initially adopted in the 1970s and 80s, but that canard flouts a mountain of historical evidence. For example, James Madison could not have been clearer. In the exposition of constitutions, many important errors would be produced, if not controllable, by a recurrence to the original and authentic meaning attached to their words and phrases. Scalia and Garner explained in Reading Law that in the English-speaking nations, the earliest statute dedicated to statutory interpretation, enacted by the Scottish Parliament in 1427, made it a punishable offense for counsel to argue anything other than original understanding. Now don't get me wrong. I'm not saying we should lock up the living common goodness. Instead of interacting directly with the many historical examples that contradict his conspiracy theory that originalism was invented by the conservative legal movement in the 1970s and 80s, Vermeule broadly dismisses them. Of course, he concedes. It is true that more than zero instances of originalist-like utterances can be detected across the vast landscape of our legal history. And he asserts that these examples tend to speak of the framers' intentions rather than the original meaning as understood by the ratifiers, embodying a vision of originalism
that few currently defend. But strangely, Vermeule repeatedly relies on Professor Jeff Powell's 1985 article refuting an original intentions methodology for the proposition that originalism is counter-originalism, apparently unaware that Powell's article established that the founders were originalists in the modern sense. Powell's article refutes Vermeule's invented history. Although founding era Americans did use the term intent in the context of constitutional interpretation, that usage, as Powell explained, tracked a long tradition of discerning intent solely on the basis of the words of the law and not by investigating any other sources of information about the lawgiver's purposes. At common law, Powell explained, the intent of the maker of a legal document and the intent of the document itself were one and the same. Intent did not depend upon the subjective purposes of the author. And consistent with that tradition, Powell explained that the Philadelphia framers' primary expectation regarding constitutional interpretation was that the Constitution, like any other legal document, would be interpreted in accord with its express language. Powell drew on a host of primary sources, but his discussion of the early debate about the passage by the first Congress of a bill to establish a national bank well illustrates the practice of originalism at the founding. That bill provoked an elaborate debate over constitutional interpretation within the executive branch about the scope of Congress's power, in which both sides relied on original interpretive methods. Taking the expansive view, Hamilton argued that wherever, whatever may have been the intention of the framers of the Constitution or of a law, that intention is to be sought for in the instrument itself. Hamilton derived his knowledge of the intent of convention from the obvious and popular sense of the constitutional expression under consideration. Far from establishing, as Vermeule asserts, that the founders were not originalists, their debate about the National Bank proves that they did not in any way reject the traditional common law understanding of intent as the apparent meaning of a text. Early justices, too, practiced originalism. Chief Justice Marshall clearly embraced originalism in Ogden versus Saunders. There, Marshall identified the principles of construction which ought to be applied to the Constitution of the United States. First, that the intention of the instrument must prevail. Second, that this intention must be collected from its words. Third, that its words are to be understood in that sense in which they are generally used by those for whom the instrument was intended. And finally, that its provisions are neither to be restricted into insignificance nor extended to objects not comprehended in them nor contemplated by its framers. Vermeule cannot seriously dismiss Marshall's opinion as an originalist-like utterance. We can go earlier still for rejections of living common goodism. Justice James Iredell wrote in Calder versus Bull in 1798 that if Congress or any state legislature shall pass a law within the general scope of their constitutional power, the court cannot pronounce it to be void merely because it is, in their judgment, contrary to principles of natural justice. As he explained, the ideas of natural justice are regulated by no fixed standard. The ablest and the purest men have differed upon the subject. And he concluded, all that the court could properly say in such an event would be that the legislature, possessed of an equal right of opinion, had passed an act which, in the opinion of the judges, was inconsistent with the abstract principles of natural justice. Vermeule asserts that this interpretation of Iredell's opinion is a wild overreading. I leave it to the literate reader of English to determine whether Justice Iredell's opinion fits more comfortably with living common goodism than with originalism. Justice Iredell's observation that the ablest and the purest men have differed upon principles of natural justice is why living commingoodism in practice would be indistinguishable from living constitutionalism. Throughout Vermeule's work, the phrase common good evades concrete application except where the outcome happens to align with his own worldview. Compare Vermeule's view of the Second Amendment with that taken by Josh Hammer, who touts common good originalism. Vermeule complains that District of Columbia versus Heller was, quote, revolutionary and a startling break with the court's longstanding precedents. But Hammer rightly praises it as a sober analysis of the historical meaning of the Second Amendment. A Justice Vermeule, who says the common good requires reviewing for arbitrariness burdens on rights secured by the Bill of Rights, would have evidently dissented in Heller. And if one were to put living common goodism in the mind of a justice who disagrees with Vermeule about whether same-sex marriage is required by the common good, one would still get Obergefell versus Hodges. Vermeule asserts that it is irrelevant that there was, is, and will be disagreement between classical lawyers over the content of the common good. But he conveniently applies a different standard to disagreements among originalists. When responding to Justice Kavanaugh's point in dissent that the majority in Bostock versus Clayton County misapplied originalism, Vermeule insists that if originalism is so difficult that one of its leading champions cannot apply it correctly, one might conclude instead that originalism is simply a dangerously unreliable technology, one that induces fatal rates of human error. But Vermeule cannot have it both ways. He cannot forgive disagreements about the common good among classical lawyers while condemning originalism based on disagreements among its proponents. I will close by reading from Justice Benjamin Curtis's dissent in Dred Scott versus Sanford. I do so because Vermeule repeatedly invokes the living constitutionalist myth that Dred Scott is, quote, the most clearly proto-originalist decision. Justice Curtis, like the courts that later rejected Riggs, repudiated the approach that would allow judges to read unmentioned exceptions into unambiguous text. When addressing whether the Supreme Court had the authority to insert into the Constitution an exception of the exclusion or allowance of slavery to Congress's express power to make all needful rules and regulations respecting territories, Curtis rejected Chief Justice Taney's majority opinion as anti-textualist. Here's what he wrote. To engraft on the Constitution a substantive exception not found in it upon reasons purely political renders its judicial interpretation impossible, because judicial tribunals as such cannot decide upon political considerations. Political reasons have not the requisite certainty to afford rules of judicial interpretation. They are different in different men. They are different in the same men at different times. Vermeule 1995, Vermeule 2022. And when strict interpretation of the Constitution according to the fixed rules which govern the interpretation of laws is abandoned and the theoretical opinions of individuals are allowed to control its meanings, we have no longer a Constitution. We are under the government of individual men who for the time being have power to declare what the Constitution is according to their own views of what it ought to mean. Justice Curtis's textualist dissent in Dred Scott rejected living common goodism. So should you. I'll take some questions. Professor Strang.
Judge Pryor, especially thank you for your postcard as responding to a number of press reviews arguments in this book. That was very, that's been very increasingly influential. One question I think the Professor Reveal makes that's more moderate is the claim, I want to hear your response to it, is the claim that some, or at least many of the provisions of the Constitution in its original meaning are under determined, and therefore it's within that space that the scope of judicial power allows folks like you to utilize their conceptions of the common good. So I think that's a more moderate claim than some of the other ones. I just think that they appreciate your response.
Yeah, so I think one of the main claims he makes in that regard is he really parrots what Ronald Dworkin said about the equal protection of laws under the 14th Amendment. And I think my main response, I think that's his main case really, is, and main example is that, that there are majestic generalities that require judges to give contemporary content and specific modern applications to those majestic generalities. The problem is he does not seem to have accounted for all the originalist scholarship that has postdated Ronald Dworkin's work on that. And the answer really has been from originalist scholars is that the equal protection of laws within the meaning of the original meaning of the 14th Amendment is not. It is not an anti-discrimination provision. That the really operative provision of the 14th Amendment was meant to be the Privileges or Immunities Clause. And the specific content and understanding of that is far easier to understand. So that what he calls the majestic generalities of the Equal Protection Clause really rest on what has been shown to be an historically inaccurate supposition. And in fact, what that clause is about is giving equal enforcement and equal access to courts' rights to all persons, regardless of class or race. It seems to be, so much of the book to me is sloppy and seems to almost stop at a stopping point of maybe 1995, 2000 at the latest understanding of a lot of this debate. And a lot has occurred since then. The frequent citation to the work of Jeff Powell as supposedly establishing that originalism is counter-originalist, I think, is an example of this. When I remember when that Powell article was published, I was in law school at the time. It was a big deal because the argument was that Powell had proved that that what Attorney General Meese had been talking about, and Attorney General Meese, when he started this debate, did use intentions language, original intentions language. He did so, though, really meaning what the framers had meant as well. And Powell's article was celebrated, particularly on the left end of the political spectrum, as establishing that Meese had it all wrong. But I went and read Powell's article at the time and came away thinking that he had proved nothing really of the kind. And in fact, the debate within even the conservative legal movement had already shifted toward that more historically accurate understanding. But it's as if Vermeule is unaware of what happened after the publication of that article.
So you cite the work of Professor Alicia in a natural law account of originalism, and Professor Vermeule has actually responded to that piece of work in an article entitled Pickwickian Originalism.
Yeah, I wouldn't call a blog post an article, but you know, I mean, you know, it's like calling a book. This could be called a pamphlet, but
But fair enough.
Yes, right. So in his blog, it would be an originalism. He says that these kinds of accounts of originalism prove, I think you call it a simulacrum, which has no content in and of itself. And where I'm getting at this is he would point to scholars like Jack Balkin, who say, I'm an originalist, and you know, they kind of link it to Fetzok, and then they justify whatever they want. I have my own theories on why that is absolutely an incorrect account of originalism, but I'm curious what you would say to those charges of people who use originalism in a kind of freewheeling policy way. Thank you.
Well, if they're using originalism to just reach the results that they like, then I don't think much of it. And I don't think that sounds much like originalism. Justice Scalia often used to say, you're not much of a judge if you always like the decisions that you reach. In a way, I've always felt a little guilty about that because I really view my task as a judge as trying to get the law right. And sometimes that's really hard, but I do feel like virtually always when I have finished, I've done my best at that. That always really I've done my best. Sometimes on reflection, I look back at something and I think maybe I overlooked something and I regret that. But at the time, I always feel pretty good about my decisions because I really don't care who wins or loses. But if you're reading, substantive results into the hands of what you're trying to accomplish, then that's not originalism. That's not trying to determine what someone else at a different point of time meant by a law that they wrote and that they fixed as a rule for application in the future. People can call themselves originalists. That doesn't mean that they're faithful originalists. And the strength of the argument is where the proof is in the pudding. We should be able to evaluate. That's one of the great things about originalism. We can have debates about linguistic meaning at a particular historical moment. Sometimes the debates can be close. Sometimes they can be difficult. But you can measure the strength of weaknesses against the record that they and the argument they put forward. On the one hand, that blog post pretends that there's really not much of a difference of opinion between Professor Alisea's article and what Vermeule says he's arguing for. Read it yourself. I commend the professor's article to you. I very much appreciate the invitation to be here today, and I hope I get to come back next time. Try to make sure that it's during football season so I can see a good game. Just so long as it's a bye week in Tuscaloosa. Thank you.